It is my pleasure to introduce to you the speaker tonight. And with no further ado, I'd like to introduce Chuck.
Thank you. I'm Chuck Sheen. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi.
It's a goodly bunch here tonight. He didn't ask if there were any newcomers, so I will. Are there any brand new ones here tonight for the first little while? Yes. Give me your name, first name only.
I'm Bob.
Hi, Bob. Yes. You.
Yes.
I'm Bill. Hi, Bill. Are there any more brand new ones? There's one back there I don't recognize with the black sweater and the four eyes. Hi, Bill. I want to welcome all of you, particularly the two who are rather new. This is not the end, I can assure you, it is the beginning. For us who are alcoholics, and usually for those who are nearest and dearest to us, we find that we have never lived until we get the feel of the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Truly, this is not the end, it is the beginning. The answer that we find in Alcoholics Anonymous is the answer that we were looking for when we found the bottle. The answer that the bottle almost was, you know. For considerable time, many of us thought we'd found the answer when we found the bottle. It's chemical spirituality. A little slower than LSD, but just as thorough. But being the wrong answer, the Bible finally turns on us and makes it necessary for us to find the right answer, lest we perish. That's a good word, perish. That's the first time I ever used it. It sort of startled me. And those of us who are fortunate find our way in Alcoholics Anonymous and come up with the answer that we have had to have all our lives. I don't think we're too much different from the non-alcoholic world, but I most certainly am convinced that our timing is different. I don't know why. It's not particularly a problem to me why it is, but our timing is different. There are lots of people that live in this area. Tom and I were taking their inventories today. And we decided that probably 97% of the local residents in Laguna Beach had not found it necessary yet in their lives to find the answer that we have to have. And I don't think it's because we're better than or worse than or smarter than or dumber than or richer than or poorer than. It's simply because the timing is different. The timing is different. It's a strange thing. But I have 24 years now, by the grace of God, through the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous, in which I have not had to take a drink of liquor or a sedating or tranquilizing pill of any kind. 24 years, one day at a time. That's 8,765 days. One day at a time. Without a drink or pill. I had 25 years drinking, so you see I've got one more year to get even. And some 18 years prior to that. To look at. I can look now with fairly clear eyes at more than 50 years of life. Quite a little more than 50 years, but that's none of your business. And it becomes increasingly clear to me as I look at what happens not only to me and to you, but to many others, that we're a little different from the non-alcoholic world. We're not much different from each other. We're sort of as alike as black-eyed peas, basically, if we'd be alcoholic. But from the earth people, we're somewhat different. I happen to be one of six kids. We came along, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. And I was third. Neither the top nor the bottom of the deck. And I'm the only alcoholic in the bunch. And it's rather interesting to look at. Because we all had the same mother and dad. The same food, the same schooling, the same church, the same environment completely, and yet I'm an alcoholic and the rest of them aren't. Some years ago, Miss C and I had been to New York I was the delegate from this area to the General Service Conference. And on the way back, we had visited all these kids. All five of them we had visited. And we got back to our home, which was then in Beverly Hills. And we were sitting talking about this thing, and I was saying to Mrs. C, who happens to be a native Californian, Isn't it wonderful that all these kids are doing pretty good? They're none of them in want. They all have pretty good homes and seem to be fairly well integrated into life. And I said something that I shouldn't have said and will explain when I say it because I'm going to say it again. I said, I'm so glad that they all are doing so well. But you know something, honey? If I had to live like any one of them, I'd rather be on Skid Row. Now, I take that back. I would not. I would rather be anything rather than drunk. I would rather be dead than drunk. So I said it wrong. I wouldn't want to be on a drunk or on Skid Row. But neither would I want to be compelled to live as any one of them. And that's the reason I became an alcoholic, and they didn't. They can live that way, and I cannot. And it wasn't because I didn't want to. It was because my insides rebelled. We were talking again this afternoon, not taking your inventory, but mine. And I was saying to my son from Canada, who's considerably older than I am, he hasn't got any hair on the top of his head. Not near as pretty as I am either. But he's sober. And I was saying to him, 50 years ago, I was 17 years old, and already I was a misfit, total misfit in life. There is a thing that sort of brought this around, was we were talking about the present rebellion of youth. And of course, I have a great deal of empathy for it. And I think, I don't know, but I think I somehow rather understand it. Because 50 years ago, I was a misfit. Total misfit in life. Hadn't had a drink yet. Didn't smoke yet. I was going to say hadn't sinned yet, but I think that's a little... I think that there's something about this program being a program of honesty. And yet I was totally a misfit. I was a maverick. I was a rebel. And again, not by choice. I could not believe what my church taught, the church I was born in. I couldn't believe it. And it wasn't because I didn't want to. I wanted to. But my insides rebelled. I couldn't believe what I saw in life because I was, my insides told me that life was a good and a big and a beautiful thing. I knew there was a chair right up here for you, Ed. It's just about your size. He won't come down. You can have mine. I've got a chair up here that I'm going to use for a little while. It's expensive, however. If you get up here, it's going to cost you $2. Well, he's going to stay back there. He hasn't got $2, I guess. I knew when I was 6 years old, my insides told me that life should be like it is right now. It should be good. It should be beautiful. Free. And I looked at it and it wasn't. It was cheap and it was dirty. And it was ugly. People lied to each other. People stepped on each other's necks to get ahead. None of these things fit with my pattern. And I couldn't integrate myself into the life around me because I didn't like it. This is one of our great problems. So, as far back as I can remember, I was a misfit. And I think that alcoholism is pretty much because of this. If there was ever a bunch of people on earth that wanted to be a part of, it's the alcoholics of the world. We've sat on the fringe of life for years and years and years, wanting so much to be in it and a part of it. And we couldn't make it, you know. We were always alone. I walked alone for 43 years. 43 years I walked alone. And it's cold outside. It's plumb cold outside. But I didn't know what to do about it. First place, I didn't know what was wrong with me. And second place, I wasn't that bright. I'm a simple guy. And people tried to tell me things, and they weren't simple. For instance, just to show you what a bad job I had. When I was 13, now I hadn't sinned then. I was an old farm boy, and I didn't know much. But we were having a revival. And I used to get very sentimental when they sang those pretty songs. You know, like the old Rugged Cross. Things like that. I like that stuff. My dad was the best barn dance fiddler in my country. And I used to hide when he was making the music, you know, behind the stove someplace where they couldn't see me and cry all evening because I loved that stuff so much. And I had to cry. And so this revival came about, and I was as big as I am now, 13 years old. And I went down to get saved. And we prayed like hell. And nothing happened. Now, this is not criticism. I love everybody's religion for him. And so when things were thinning out up there and I was still working, well, the preacher came over to help me. And we prayed and prayed and prayed. And every once in a while he'd say to me, "How you doing?" And I'd say, "No good." And we'd take another hitch at it. And finally he got plumb pooped. And he says, "Well, when you get baptized, it'll happen, you know." And so when the ice went out, I went in. And when he pulled me up out of that cold water, he says, "How are you doing?" I says, "No good." And he says, "Well, when you're formally taken into church, it'll happen." And when that time came, he says, "How are you doing?" I says, "No good." Now that's when I was 13, and I began at that time to try to find out why I had gotten gypped. I knew something ought to happen, you know, and it didn't. And for the next 30 years, from 13 to 43, I was studying everything I could get my hands on. I went through all the great religions and all the great philosophies. Hunting for an answer that I needed very badly. And I learned a lot about these things, a lot about, but I didn't learn anything. At about 20, maybe 19 or 20, I found liquor. I was out of athletics by this time, and I did a little smoking, and I did a little drinking. And when I found that flipped, it wasn't a problem, it was an answer. And I bet you that every person in this room, male or female, who happens to be an alcoholic, found the same thing when they found liquor. It wasn't a problem, it was an answer. Proving that the problem was already here. If I hadn't already been a problem to myself, I wouldn't have needed an answer. But that flip did two very great things for me. Number one, it allowed me to live in my own world. And number two, it took the rough edges off of yours. It let me live a little bit more comfortably in your society, which I did not like. And so for 15 years, liquor was an answer for me. I used it as an answer. But after 15 years, my answer became a problem because it was the wrong answer in the first place. And for the next 10 years, it beat me to death. It beat me in total and absolute nothingness in January 1946. And I found this problem. I had 10 years, as Mr. C could attest, of about as hot a hell as anybody could have. If there's any hotter hell than that, I pray God I miss it. But, of course, it was necessary in my case. Every second of it was necessary in my case. Because, again, there was something wrong with me. In my family, the word surrender was long since eliminated. It wasn't even in our vocabulary. My people don't surrender. They're still fighting the Civil War. Yeah, they are. And surrender was for the weak. And of course, you don't surrender. You win. A strong man wins his battle. A weak man surrenders. And I could not do it. I simply couldn't do it. And all my conditioning was against it. For instance, I had a brother who was 3 years and a half older than I, and 3 years and a half stronger. And we had one fight that lasted 20 years on the installment plan. And the guy could always whip me, and he couldn't make me believe it. Always, and he couldn't make me believe it. And as a result, he had to whip me for 20 years straight. And I left home at 20 thinking I could whip him. So I was a little bit, you're not very bright when you do like that. 10 years prior to that, if I'd have had any brains, I'd have gone to him and I'd have said, Joe, you can whip me, old boy. Now, when you get a notion that you're going to do it, tell me, and I'll agree with you that you can, and we'll save a lot of old clothes and eyes. This is getting so it hurts. So you just ask me, and I'll tell you, you can whip me. And I could have saved a lot of trouble, but no, I left home thinking I could whip him. When I was 16, my oldest brother and myself and my dad went down to the farm where I was raised, and we went with my father's father around looking at the old home place. And Joe and I were in a constant show-off stage. We were doing things for the old men. And proving which one of us was the best, you know. And we got back to the barn lot, and there was a great big ditch through the barn lot. It was both deep and wide. And the men came up there and stood on the edge of this ditch, and we're talking about what ought to be done about it, I guess. And immediately, Joe and I started figuring out if we could jump it, you know. Joe finally decided it was no good, that it couldn't be done. And I said, well, I can do it. I can jump that thing. Now, you get down the bottom of this ditch so you can catch me. If I miss, I won't break my neck, and I'm going to try it. And I got back and took a good run at it and leaped, and I almost made it. I almost made it. I got my toes on the other side and went over backwards, and Joe caught me, and there wasn't any necks broken. But there was something happened that was pretty bad. I suspect that this thing that I'm just now telling you was responsible for the last 5 years of my drinking. Because when I came crawling out of that ditch, my grandfather was telling my dad, he says, "Bill, you got a winner here." He says, "I've been watching this kid ever since he was born." And he says, "Nothing in life will ever beat him." He says, "He cannot be licked." And I happened to hear it. I suspect that was responsible for the last 5 years, which were my worst years of drinking. Because I had to beat that thing. I had to. And I rode it until the last ditch was crossed. And I, in January 1946, I was a failure in every department of life. Failure as a husband, a father, a businessman, a man, and a drunk. I had used all of my resources. I had nothing left. Had there been anything for me to do but throw in the towel, I couldn't have made it. If there had been a river to cross, I couldn't have crossed it. I had nothing left. But since the primary condition is to accept ourselves as we are, where we are, right now, this happened to me, and I haven't had to have a drink or a pill since. And for those who are new, surrender is victory for us who are alcoholics. Surrender is victory. As long as I worked on my problem, it grew. It was just like cultivating, watering, and fertilizing a weed. It grew out of all proportions. And it was only when I took my eyes off the problem and started looking at and attempting to live in the answer that the problem disappeared. So, if you're beating your brains out, quit it. You can't win. The battle that I fought for 10 long years, the last 10 years of 25-year drinking career, nobody has ever won. Nobody. It sort of takes the sting out of the defeat when you recognize or realize that nobody ever won it. If one person in life had ever won it, we might still have something to grumble about, but nobody ever did. So it's not so bad to lose one when nobody ever won it. So surrender is victory for us. It's just as silly for an alcoholic to decide to quit drinking as it is for a tubercular to decide to quit coughing. If you have tuberculosis and you want to get rid of the cough, there's one way that you can do it, and that's to get rid of the cause, which is tuberculosis. And we have to get rid of the cause of our drinking, and it's a living problem, and we have to have a living answer. And such an answer we find in our program of Alcoholics Anonymous. All we have to do is fulfill the conditions of our program. And we find the answer. We don't have to drink, which is number one. This is a society of non-drinkers. Sometimes we forget to tell our young new members that. They show up for a month or two or a drunk, you know, at our meetings. They think that as long as they're here, they're making an effort, you know. And we forget to tell them that you're not supposed to drink when you come to these meetings. It helps, you know. It's pretty difficult to get sober and drinking. you don't make many points, you know, sober not drinking. Don't work. I I never did taper off in my life. God, at the last I had great ambitions to sober up whilst drinking. I would be drunk on whiskey, and so at some time when I'd have to sober up because there was pressures brought to bear. I would buy beer by the case or wine by the gallon to sober up on, you know. And that'd last me about another week. I could kid him around the house into thinking that I was making a valiant effort because I was off of the booze, you know, the whiskey. But I tell you something, I can get just as drunk on beer as I could on the stuff I've been drinking. There's not too much difference. Beer's a little wetter than whiskey. I can get just as drunk on wine as I could on the stuff I was drinking. But it's a little bit different, wine is. Wine, you can run around for 3 or 4 weeks, 3 feet off the sidewalk, and never touch anything. A friend of mine used to say, it's the only thing I've ever heard of that can hang you without a rope, and it does. It does. So whilst I've tapered on many times, I always tapered off. I'd sample my way back to bed, you know, every time. But I never tapered off in my life. The only way I know to sober up is don't drink. And so this is a great help to us. We want to get sober, don't drink. And then apply these principles to yourself and you won't have to start drinking again. You see, we never had any trouble stopping. All of us. Even the habituals had to stop once in a while. Because they'd get too sick to drink, or they'd get gambling around on somebody else's greed. The gendarmes would get them and detain them without their permission, you know. One of the easiest ways in the world to sober up is to walk up and kick a cop in the seat of the pants. You sober up in a hurry. They detain you and don't give you anything to drink. So, we get sober so that we can then do something about our problem, which is alcoholism. Now, why am I not drunk tonight? Because I have the thing I was looking for in the bottle. That's the only reason I'm not drunk. I have the thing I was looking for in the bottle. What is the thing? I don't hurt in here anymore. That king-size hurt is gone. One of the things that sold me on you youngsters in this place, and I'll tell you, it was a great surprise to me because I knew that you couldn't do this. I knew that none of you muckies that were under 40 could ever make this program, well, say under 30. You couldn't do it because you couldn't surrender. I knew because I looked at me and I couldn't surrender at 15, at 20, at 25, at 30, at 35, or 40. It took me 43 years to surrender the first time. And then it was done for me. The body did it. So I knew you couldn't do it, you know. And therefore, you'd just have a little few weeks or so in the program, and then you'd be out there messing around again, getting ready. The thing that took my bait was to hear some of you monkeys get up there and up here where I am and talk about not coming to the program to get rid of the bottle or to get rid of the needle or the pot, but to get rid of the big hurt. To get rid of the big hurt. And they talked about standing on a street corner with a big hole in their guts and the wind blowing through. And they knocked me off the Christmas tree because I didn't think they knew about that. I knew about it. But I didn't think they did. But they did. And they're doing a hell of a job in this program. We got them, a lot of them, under 20, that are doing real good with this program. And we love it. Now, the conditions are very simple. To accept ourselves as we are where we are right now. To come to see that sobriety is tops on our hit parade. When anybody comes to see that sobriety is first. When one comes into the feeling that he'd rather be dead than to take that next drink. He neither has to drink or die. Sobriety must come first. Or we can't have it, and it must remain first, or we can't keep it. And then enough self-honesty to apply these principles to ourselves one day at a time to the best of our ability. The recognition of the need for help and the application of these principles to our lives. And that's it. And that's for the two new people. Now I'm starting over. You're not getting rid of me yet. But I'm starting over because much of my AA life, I have been accused of not having any problems. You know, people hearing me usually think that I came here and I've never had a problem since I got here. Because I don't often talk about the problem since I got here, because I have had probably, my life has been as free of problems as almost anybody's life that ever came to the program. Because there are two or three things that almost don't get away from me in my living experience. Number one, there is nothing about these last 24 years that I can take credit for, and I know it. You see, if I could have remained in left field and survived, I'd still be out there, and I know that. I couldn't even come to this program until I'd lost everything, including the power of choice. Because when I had choice, my choice was never to come here. And I didn't come as long as I had choice. I'd run out of that along with everything else before I could come. So there's nothing that I can take credit for. Number one. And number two, you, the members of Alcoholics Anonymous, have kept me so damn busy that I don't hardly ever have time to think I want, I don't want, I like, I don't like. I don't have time. And therefore, I don't want anything for myself. And if you ever want to be free, that's it. When you don't want nothing, no time for yourself, you're a free man. And I've had this most of my life in Alcoholics Anonymous. I got here totally done in. And things have gotten better since I got here until now. But there have been times when it appeared that life had gone black, the world had gone black. And so we're going to talk about a few of those little things and how we get rid of them. I think one of the reasons that this is fresh in my mind now, Mrs. C and I, in 1969, had more people come to us with from 5 to 20 years sobriety. That is, without a drink, and hadn't had a drink yet, but who were just ready to explode, who were just ready to fly apart. It seemed like you could touch them and they'd just blow up like a bomb or something. And we've had to look at this pretty closely. And thank God, my own experience had given me a few answers, and I have been able to fall back on them since. The first big thing that came about in my life that was almost a destroyer was that back in, when I was about 7 years sober, there was a Stop Chamberlain movement in Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, somebody had decided that I was going someplace. But I wasn't. I had been. And so there was a Stop Chamberlain movement, and it got to be quite a little thing. One meeting that I was told about, there were 22 groups represented in this Stop Chamberlain thing that night, and it was very serious. And the only thing that saved me in that connection was that I never allowed myself to get emotionally involved in it. I never got emotionally involved in the problem, and I never had to get drunk. But if I had allowed myself to get emotionally involved in it, I would have gotten drunk and destroyed myself because I couldn't have taken it. Because you can't win an emotional argument. Now, those of you who have been fighting your kids and your wives and your bosses and everybody else, put this down and take it with you and play with it a while. It is impossible to win an emotional argument. It cannot be done. Those of you who are fathers or mothers, well, remember that you couldn't win an emotional argument with a baby that's 2 days old. You can't win an emotional argument. And so, don't get in it. And 12-step work. If you want to destroy yourself, get in the gutter with the people you're trying to help. Get down there with them. There's no way to help them. If you get all emotionally involved, the only possibility is stay above the problem. Then you can help. You're not in the problem; you're in the answer, and you can help. And so I stayed out of an emotional involvement and lived through that thing. The next thing that happened was in my 11th year. And it was real rough. Because I had to lose and win when I was right. And if you don't think that's a tough one, get involved in it. 11 years before, I'd had to lose and win when I was wrong. But this time, I had to lose and win when I was right. And it involved a very large sum of money. And I had come to see in the years prior to this that this was my security. Quickly, I had made a deal for my boss. And made a development for him. And I did it for nothing, because he didn't throw me through the window when I came back to the office after my last drunk. He had sent word to the house that if I ever set foot in the plant again, he's going to throw me through the window. And he came in to do it, but something had already happened to me, and he didn't. And from that time until the time I'm telling you about, we'd been as one person. And so I made him this deal, and when I made it, he said, Charlie, I didn't want that. I don't want it at all. I don't need it. He says, I've done this for you, and I'm giving you 25% of it. And so you go ahead now and build this thing up, and we'll have something to retire on. Because just as soon as I get you in the shape I'm in, we'll retire. That's all I'm working for now, is to get you in the same position I'm in. And this thing, to make a long story short, turned into a gold mine. And when it came time for him to retire, which was 14 years ago, my portion of it had been worth $500,000. And all this time we had talked of this thing, and we'd laughed about it, and we'd cried about it. And he was so interested in my work, and we'd go to lunch and talk, and he'd cry like a baby. He was very close to me in those years. But he loved money. And when it came time for him to give up a pot of gold, he couldn't do it. So he had to deny the whole thing. And here I was. All right, up until today, I'm worth $500,000. And tomorrow, I'm not worth a damn. You see? And subconsciously, I had come to see this as my security. And ladies and gentlemen, I had a year that was as tough as any year ever was. I think it was tougher than any year I ever drank. Because everything in me announced that I was right. I knew I was right. All the way through, I knew I was right. And my insides would tell me, you can't let him do this. This is for your wife and for your kids. This is our security. You can't let him do this. And again, it would tell me, my insides, you can't let him do this to himself. You can't allow him to do it. I love the guy. And then came counsel, and they said, Chuck, you can take him to the court of equity and beat him hands down. You've got every witness in town. Because everybody knew of this. Not only from me, but from him. And you can beat him hands down. And I'd been with him 20 years, so I couldn't take him to court. And I'm an alcoholic, and I couldn't judge him or resent him. Because if I did, I'd get drunk, and if I got drunk, I'd die. And in my country, we call that being between a rock and a hard place. And I was there for a year, and it just ground me into nothing. Because of the inner conflict, well, somehow or another, I came to see in time that there's only one security, and that's my own relationship with my own God. And I was able to call him in one night and say to him, I'm going through this deal with you once more. And I don't want you to let me say one thing that isn't right. If I say one thing that isn't exactly like it was, stop me. And I went through it. And when I got through it, I said, Victor, you didn't stop me. And he says, no. I says, is that exactly the way it happened, Victor? And he says, yes, it is. And I says, all right, Victor, you take it. You need it. I don't need it. God bless you. Go about your business. And he slipped off my back, and everything else slipped off my back. Now, that has been one of the greatest living lessons that I have ever learned. Because only in very short periods since then have I ever been without the conscious awareness that this is the only security I have. And that's my own relationship with my own God. And so, again, what are we talking about? We're talking about applying the principles that we learn in this program to every problem in life. And the time comes quite often when we have to turn a crisis into an opportunity. We have to. And it's almost always possible by saying to myself, and particularly to myself, because I'm up here so often, look, big boy, you so often glibly say, I have made a decision to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Now, where did you get off of this self-concern? How far are you willing to go? And you turn the crisis into an opportunity because you go the next step and you surrender to the next plane. And you've turned it into growth instead of self-destruction. It's a fantastic thing. And we've got all the tools, kids. We've got them all. We're the most fortunate people on earth. Well, incidentally, that's the reason I'm amongst you. That 11th year, because thinking we were going to retire, we bought our house in Laguna Beach. And the next thing you know, we ain't got no retirement. But we've got our house. And we've got you. And it's been a good move. We've loved it. So, inasmuch as we didn't retire, we had to buy the business. He retired. And so I got me a partner. And we bought the business. And the guy that I got to go with me was a chap that I had called upon 3 years before, 4 years before, when he was dying and he got sober. And I thought we were walking down the same road. And he was in the refrigeration business. Where are you? Hi. I was in the market fixture business, manufacturing market fixtures. And this gave us a complete package, and I thought it was the most beautiful marriage on earth. And we bought the thing 50-50. And we didn't have it 2 months before I knew that I'd made a mistake. Because we weren't walking down the same road. We weren't thinking in the same vein at all. He had one idea about business and I had another. And the battle started. And it continued for almost a year. And it looked like I was going to have to start over because one of us had to buy the other one out. And I didn't have any money. Everything I had was in the business. And it looked like I was going to have to start over in a garage someplace. It was awful bad. Really, it was a rough time. And again, something happened. And I was able to buy him out. A series of miracles that would curl your hair. And so we bought him out. And another crisis was averted. But I got to tell you business guys one more thing in line with this. After about 6 months, I stopped bringing in business because my people depend on me to execute. And I didn't think I was going to be there to execute, and I wouldn't bring in business because I wouldn't take that chance with my people. And so when things worked out so I could buy the business, I bought a vacant plant. And it took $13,500 a week to keep the doors open. And I didn't have it. And so it was necessary for me to go get some business, and quick. You know, I had to go get it. Well, now, 12 years before, I had started doing business a little different than I'd ever done it in my life. I had started making 12-step calls in business. And that's all. Just helping people do things they need to have done because of want to. In business, in play, in AA, in home, the works. But here I had a problem, a money problem that was very vital and very serious. So I had to go get some business. And there were six deals that I thought I could get because I had done much to make me feel that I could go get them. And one after another, they evaporated. One after another. But there was one that could not get away. It was mine, born, bred, and preserved. It was all mine. Because the two principals of the company were members of this leper colony of ours. And 28 of their high echelon were members of this leper colony. Every time I went to the Long Beach area, 30 of them were sitting right in front of me, the first row. And we loved each other, you know. And I'd done all the planning, all the thinking, everything, and so this was my deal. And I went down there to get it. This was the last one. And I got to have it. So I went down there to get it. And a half a dozen of us went to lunch and had a good time. And then we came back to the place and all of them disappeared, but one of these fellows and myself, one of the principals. And we went in his office and I thought it was sort of funny. They disappeared like rats leaving a sinking ship, you know. But I thought, well, it's time for them to go to work. We've taken a little bit too much time for lunch. And we went into this guy's office and I reached for the money. And the guy says to me, Chuck, he says, I didn't think you had a Chinaman's chance of working out that goddamn mess you were in it there. So I gave this deal to him. That was the last one. I gave it to him. 5 minutes later, he said to me, why don't you say something, Chuck? And I said, hell, there's nothing to say. And there wasn't. Boy, it was black. And I left his office and I got in the car and started back to town. They couldn't make it. I drove off the road. And I looked and there wasn't anything to look at. And again, something had to happen. So, I turned the clock back. And I said to myself, why don't you do this thing like you've always done for the last 12 years? Why don't you forget about getting something and help people do things they need to have done because you want to? Why don't you start making 12-step calls again in business like you've been doing it and get this thing off your shoulders and let the chips fall where they may? And I did. And the place filled up. And it's been full ever since. A crisis, again, turned into an opportunity. I'm going to tell you about one more, and then quit. Recently, my ex-dear employment called me in and wanted to know if I would sign a long-term lease on the premises that I was leasing from him. And he said that the people on both sides of me wanted the property that I was occupying. And they were both willing to sign long-term leases. And I was happened to be the last of the Mohicans. I was the last manufacturer of supermarket fixtures on a custom basis, the last one in the city of Los Angeles. And my business depended largely on one client. I don't mind telling you who it was, Bonds Markets. I've been doing the business for 35 years. And they had stayed with me. And so, if they left me, I couldn't have paid the rent. And so Victor says, how about a long-term lease? And I said, Victor, can't do it. I'll give you a 100-year lease if you'll give me the same privileges I have now. And that is an escape clause. All I have to do is give him a written notice that I'm going to move out in a year and I can move out. I said, I'll do that. And I paid you over $300,000 rent, and I've never met a day late yet. And I hope to pay you $300,000 more. But I can't sign a long-term lease because I can't take a chance on this. Well, he says, I'm going to stay with you. Says, I won't know what you forget it. I'm doing you a hell of a favor, and don't forget it. And I says, oh, I won't. And it wasn't very long after that until it came through on the ticker that Household Finance had bought bonds. And bonds were now a wholly owned subsidiary of Household Finance. And I heard that, and I said, uh-oh, I'm going to have a visitor. I'd quit. And in a few days, I did. Here comes the man. And I said, I've been expecting you. He said, why? Well, I said, I knew that you'd be scared to death. And he said, how'd you know that? Well, I said, you read the report just as I did. Bonds are... Well, I said, yes, I did. Now he says, what's that going to do to you? Well, I said, it's going to help me. I've already talked to them, and they've told me that the management's not going to change. And they tell me until the management changes, I won't change. That I'll be doing the work. And they also tell me that they're going to compound their expansion program. So it ought to be very good for me. He says, how long is the management not going to change? Well, they sure don't know. But he says, that's the catch. So he got up and went over and leased my place to somebody else. Leased it out from under me. And when I found out this, again, I'm dying. What am I going to do, you know? What am I going to do? My oldest son was living in business, and he's done a whale of a job. I pretty nearly had to provide a place for him because this is the only thing he knew. And the trade loved him, and he loved the business. So now I said to myself, I've got to go out and sign maybe 20 of these. And then I've got to spend $75,000 for machinery. And I'm going to be broke again. And again, I'm looking at an awful black sea. And about a week I had, I said, it was pretty bad. What am I going to do? And then again, it occurred to me, well, if you've been telling these monkeys that have been coming all year to turn their crisis into an opportunity. Now, why don't you try a little bit of this medicine, see what you can do about it? And so again, I had to surrender. And the first thing you know, I was down in the labor meeting, and I said to one of my competitors, I didn't say to him, he said to me, He said, Charlie, why don't you buy me out? And I said, oh, it's working pretty good. Maybe this drink's not going to be as bad as I thought it was. And on the way back to the office, I thought again. And there was a firm here in town that had been trying to buy me for 10 years, and I wouldn't talk to them. So I said, maybe they still want me. And I went over and said, if you want me, I'm ready. And they said, name your price. And so I sold. And Bill went to the business. And if I don't live too long, I won't get hungry. Now, why am I telling you this? Because this is an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, and it sounds like a True Confessions or something. Well, the thing is that we have a formula that will allow us to obtain and maintain sobriety. But the principles of the formula that allows us to obtain and maintain sobriety also allow us to obtain and maintain a good way of life. A good way of life that makes it unnecessary for us to drink. And also, the same conditions that allow us to obtain and maintain sobriety are the conditions that allow us to discover a God of our very own. A God of our very own. Now, we talked in the beginning about a difference in timing. A difference in timing. I had a client for years, God rest his soul, he died last summer. He was a Syrian. And he was 10 years younger than I. And he'd gone from one head of lettuce to $35 million. And I hasten to assure you that I didn't do quite that well. And Eddie used to say to me, Charlie, how can I be like you? And I'd say, you can't, Eddie. And he'd say, why? And I'd say, Eddie, who needs God when he has $35 million? You see? Who needs him? Now, you've done pretty well. And you can buy anything you want, including women. And you do, because the Syrians think they're God's gift to women. Now, they may be. Maybe some of you know more about that than I do. But here the guy was, buying everything that he wanted. And he says, how can I be like you? And so I said, tell you now, Eddie, you go ahead, like your goal, and make yourself 150 million. And you will, if you live, there's no way to keep you from it, because everything you touch turns to money. And when you've got 150 million, then you come to me and you say, Charlie, how can I be like you? And I'll tell you. Because by this time you will find that freedom is an inside job. That money can't do it. That nothing else out there can do it, but something inside can do it. And so you come and I'll tell you, and you can do it, and we'll do it together. But poor Eddie didn't live that long. He was making money so fast that he exploded. He had a massive brain thing, and we had to bury it. But he was a hell of a nice guy. Now, what am I saying to you? I'm saying this, that it is not normal for us to walk alone. It is not normal for us to walk alone. I walked alone for 43 years. It's not normal. It's cold outside. It's normal for us to walk down the high road of life with our arms around each other, sharing our experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. This is normal. And this is AA. This is what we do. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope one with another in love. That they might solve their common problem and help others recover from alcoholism. This is normal. This is beautiful. It's good. And it's not normal for us to be away from home. It's not normal to be away from the Father's house. It's normal to be as little children, totally dependent on this great thing called God. This is normal. And this too is AA. Because this is the discovery we make when we apply the principles of the Alcoholics Anonymous program to our very own lives for sobriety. For sobriety. We find God as a byproduct of doing things for an entirely different reason. Not hunting God. I'd hunted God for 35 years before I got here, as I told you. Hunting your God, the God of the great religions. And I couldn't find it. Came here not looking for it, not even hoping to find it, hoping only for sobriety, that I might find a way to live that didn't include the bottle. I did the things that people just like you told me to do. Drunks who were not drunk, says here are the steps we took. Do these things and see what happens to you. And I did them for sobriety. And I found sobriety. And I found you and I found God. It's a fantastic thing. Now we find him where he is, and this is the beauty of our society. This is the great destiny of Alcoholics Anonymous. And if they don't blow us up, the leaven that is Alcoholics Anonymous will eventually leaven the whole loaf. It's beginning now. I thought it would have happened before now, that it don't happen that quick. But you see, our great destiny is not that we're going to sober up a few drugs. But we can't fulfill our destiny if we do anything other than that. If we do anything besides carrying the message successfully to the alcoholic who still suffers, we cannot fulfill our destiny. But doing that, our destiny is to usher in the next great step in the evolutionary process of man. And that's putting God right back in the middle of his creation, where he's always been. And where theology took him out and put him someplace else. We find him where he is, right here, where he has always been. You see, the reason I couldn't find your God is because he's uniquely you. And the reason you can't find mine is because he's uniquely me. You see. And so we find this out in AA. And it allows us to say, freedom is an inside job. It allows the black man, the Jew, the Gentile, and the Greek to say, freedom is an inside job. It allows us to walk in the living presence of the Almighty and never be alone again. We never have to walk alone anymore. It's fantastic. And it's the way it is. And we discover where it is, right here. And it's uncovering, discovering, and then discarding. This is life. You see, we don't come here to learn a lot of intellectual things. We come here and discard, and discard, and discard. The things that the society that we've lived in have conditioned us to believe were true about this thing called life, that are absolutely contrary to our living experience. Now here, with this, I'll sit down. You know, the carpenter said, "Fear not, little flock. It's the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. To give us the kingdom." Let's forever get rid of the idea that we can earn it. Let's forever get rid of the idea that we have to be worthy of it. The man never lived, or the woman, who was worthy of or had earned the life that's mine. Even the carpenter, when they said to him, "Good master, good master," he says, "Why callest thou me good?" He says, "There's only one that is good, and that's the Father." And when they said to him, "You're doing some pretty fancy didos, old boy. How do you do it? What's the secret of this thing?" He says, "Go peddle your papers, I don't. Of myself, I can do nothing. It's the Father within, he doeth the works." And if he could say that, what's wrong with me saying it? Because he's made the widest track of anybody that ever walked on this continent. So you see, it is the Father's good pleasure to give us the kingdom. But not on our terms, on his. And his terms are so simple, the world can't see them. All he tells us to do is to tend his sheep. "Tend my sheep," he says. You remember he called Peter in just before he left. Pete seemed to be probably the favorite, because he was a maverick, too. I've thought many times that he might just well have been an alcoholic, you know. Because when he got caught in the act, you know, he lied himself out of it, you see. They said, "Jim, you're one of these monkeys, aren't you?" He said, "Never saw him before." Never saw him before. So he lied himself right out of the deal. And being a maverick, I guess, like us, the carpenter liked him pretty good. So he called him in. He says, "Peter, do you love me?" "Yes, Lord." "Tend my sheep." And he asked him a second time, "Peter, do you love me?" He says, "Yes, Lord." "Tend my sheep." And the third time he asked him. And the third time he says, "Tend my sheep." And this is the end. So we go about our Father's business and prove conclusively to ourselves that we are his children. God bless you. Thank you very much.